Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, City Visions takes you to the theater. Historically, the theater has been one of the ways people got information, engaged with each other, and built community. But now, as theater competes with other faster news sources, from the internet to mic checks and the Occupy movement, what is the role of theater in the Bay Area? Well, we're going to ask our guests that question tonight, and some more questions specifically about how Bay Area theater organizations are balancing their artistic vision with the unprecedented stress driven by the loss and reduction of financial support. And how are they trying to draw in new audience members? So who's going to the theater and why, and who's not, and how can we get them into the theater? And how are communities seeing themselves reflected in theater works or not? Joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these questions and more are Sean San Jose. He's a staff member of Intersection for the Arts, the program director of their performance program, and one of the co-founders of their resident theater company, Camposanto. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you for having me on. I'm a big fan of KLW, so I'm happy to be on the air.
Great. And we're also joined by Karen D'Souza. She's theater critic for the Bay Area Newspaper Group. She has twice sat on the Pulitzer Prize drama jury, has served as vice chair for the American Theater Critics Association, and her writing has appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, Los Angeles Times, and American Theater Magazine. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much. It's so much fun to be here. And it's great to have something to do on Monday night, right?
Besides theater. Right. So, and as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We're going to open our phones in about 20 minutes or so, and you can join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Just go to City Visions. So, Karen D'Souza, I wanted to start with you just to give us a sense of the landscape of theater in the Bay Area in terms of the sizes of theaters that we have, the numbers, the kinds of works that are being produced here. Just what's the state of the health of theater here?
The lucky thing about the Bay Area is that we are blessed. And I think, you know, I think really probably this has been true since the 70s, but I would say since at least the mid-90s, when I started really paying attention to theater in the Bay Area, there's been an explosion really on every level, from really big budget shows that go from San Francisco to New York to Broadway oftentimes, to small underground theaters producing new works. There's really more theater being done on every level, from every city, from San Jose to Walnut Creek to Berkeley to San Francisco, than I think has ever really been true in the history of the Bay Area. It's actually a real golden age for Bay Area theater.
And it started in the 70s, and it's still going as far as you can tell?
Well, I think there are cycles in the kinds of works we see. Certainly, I think there is more interest now in commercial properties, Memphis, American Idiot, things that have an eye towards a commercial life or a Broadway life, whereas I think in the 70s maybe it wasn't quite that cool to have an eye to Broadway, and people were more interested in you know, maybe playing with the form or really avant-garde work. But I think in general, I think research and development, I think, is part of the Bay Area cultural landscape. I think we all are attracted to new things, new voices, new ways of telling stories. And I think you really see that in the Bay Area theater scene.
So if you could give us a sense of how much of the theater scene is really occupied by the more commercial, as you call it, or big box is another term I've heard, entities versus smaller, independent, and you even mentioned underground groups. Can you give us a sense of the spread?
I don't know if you could necessarily say, I mean, there's an ecosystem. I think you've probably seen the most growth probably in terms of small theater companies, small independent theater companies, younger theater companies with a specific cultural or racial basis than maybe on the higher end, you know, the ACTs and the Berkeley Reps, Theater Works, San Jose Rep, those kinds of big budget institutions. I think it's harder to grow them. Mm. It takes a long time. It can take decades, really, to build like a funding base and patrons and subscribers. So probably I think where you've seen the most growth is in terms of smaller organizations.
And are you saying that that means the big box theaters are struggling more than the smaller ones, or does that not necessarily be?
Actually, as far as I can see, I mean, I think about a year and a half ago, we did a study in the Bay Area from the newspaper in terms of, you know, a lot of organizations are having economic trouble. And why is that? Is it that the ticket sales are slumping, or, you know, what's the reason? And what we found almost across the board is that attendance tends to be up. Everyone is selling more tickets. by and large, than they ever have before. Where they're really hurting is in terms of donations. Corporate funding has fallen off. Certainly, you know, there really isn't any kind of government subsidy for the arts, certainly not like there used to be. And that's where people are hurting. And that's, I think, where the trouble comes from. On the higher end of the spectrum, or the larger end, you know, ACT and Berkeley Rep, they have had an easier time, I think, transitioning to a different donor model where you appeal to individuals, you know, well-heeled patrons of the arts, who can make up for an economic downturn by writing a larger check. They believe in the organization. And there's a certain amount of prestige involved with giving to, you were saying big box, I would say a major house, okay. You know, a major showcase theater. There's a certain amount of prestige. Sometimes you get your name on the wall and they'll name a lounge after you, that kind of thing. I think so. They have an easier time turning to that model. On the lower end of the spectrum, I mean, the artists are poor and hungry, always have been, and probably always will be. So I think they have an easier time doing a down and dirty thing. Everybody works harder. Everybody works longer. Everybody does what it takes to pull the art off. I think the organizations in the middle have the most trouble. They can't really go down and dirty. They don't know how to do that. Mm. And they can't tap into the old money support.
And what are examples of those kinds of places?
You know, I was thinking San Jose Rep would be an example. Mm. You know, not a small organization, but not a huge one either. So really people who have to work harder in a downturn where discretionary income is a question for most people.
So bigger entities are able to be more nimble and pull in other types of donors, and the smaller entities are able to take risks in ways that draw in more audience. Is that a good way to kind of frame that?
I think that's really true.
So that was Karen D'Souza. She's theater critic for the Bay Area Newspaper Group. I wanted to bring in Sean San Jose, who's a staff member at Intersection for the Arts and program director of the Performance Program and one of the co-founders of their resident theater company, Campo Santo. Where do you see Intersection for the Arts, Campo Santo, fitting in this spectrum that Karen is describing?
Well, I think what Karen describes is pretty accurate. What you always note, though, I think, about the Bay Area is Karen talked about the middle having the struggle. I mean, what's interesting, if you really break it down, is that we really don't have a middle. You know, we have about, Karen listed them, we have about four or five larger houses, and then you have everyone else doing their thing. I mean, there are places like, say, the Magic Theater. Loretta Greco runs that, and that size of a house and that history of a house is something that I think is doesn't exist anymore. Insofar as what Karen was referring to, you know, a group starting from the ground up with an artistic director and a vision and building something up that is sizable but not mammoth, and then you have mammoth things like. I mean, you look at Berkeley Rep. Berkeley Rep is like, they got like city blocks in Berkeley, you know what I mean? And then you have the rest of the folks. I mean, what's exciting, and I completely agree with Karen, is that this is a great era. It seems like if you look back at any era in the Bay Area, though, it's always dynamic. It's always happening. It's always alive. And, you know, whether that's just the history and the ethos of the place, or being a port city, being a place that is at the edge of the country like this, it's in the air that way. And I think we mix performance, art, food, whatever culture it is, we mix that in more fluidly maybe than other places. So the notion that I think sometimes people don't refer to this as a theater town or whatever cultural town in specific ways like that, but I think it is. It is all of those things, and it's always all of those things. And that's why you're going to always have, you have hundreds of small companies, and they're constantly new ones are starting. They get past that 3-year threshold, and the ones that are really strong and are really going to fight stay on. And you have just as many dance companies that are doing that too, and obviously music too. And I say all those together because I actually think all of those live in the same world together. And I think sometimes we sort of confuse the matter with an older paradigm by saying theater exists over here and dance exists over here and music.
Right.
I just don't think that's true of the Bay Area. I just don't think it's accurate. And so I think that's where we don't necessarily get that clear actual picture that you look in the audiences and see the people. It's mixed up, just like the Bay Area is mixed up in all ways like that.
Mm-hmm. Karen, you looked like you wanted to add something there.
I think it's absolutely true what Sean is saying. I think in the end, it's sort of a mistake to try and quantify the arts. Mm. How do you quantify success? You have a really big budget. Does that mean you're more successful than somebody who did an amazing show with $5,000 of a budget? I don't think that that's true. I mean, look at Angels in America. That came out of San Francisco. It came out of a theater company that is now, you know, largely defunct. But it changed the scope of global theater for, you know, probably decades. So I think the way we look at art has to, and the way we look at money, I think that's an explosive relationship that you sort of have to really look at it closely.
Hmm. So back to you, Sean. So then tell us a little bit about Intersection for the Arts and Campo Santo and just and what's the vision of that organization or organizations as they see their mission to provide theater to the Bay Area.
Yeah, I mean, I think what sets it apart a little bit is that Intersection for the Arts is an older institution, nearly 50 years old, started in 1965, started as, you know, sort of maybe pre this term, you know, an interdisciplinary place, a place for people to commune, a place for people to read poetry, a place for people to talk politics, talk religion. And I think that basic mission holds true to today. I think what's special about being at an Intersection for the Arts is that it's a home for many places. So you're also just going to get a diversity of feeling, a diversity of energy, a diversity of cultures, a diversity of people, whether it's, and that's why, again, like, break down barriers. You know, you have visual art, you have music, you have literature, you have workshops, you have education and theater, and it's all in the same place, and it's all, so it's a little, to me, it's always been exciting because it's a little closer to what outside of these buildings look, and I think that's what we're always trying to do in cultural institutions is mirror as closely as we can the street that we're on or the neighborhood we're in or the city that we're in. Intersection, interestingly, we're right in the middle of big changes. For years, for more than 20 years, Intersection have been in the Mission on Valencia Street. And we've, since April, have been down in the San Francisco Chronicle building. There's huge things happening down there with developer Forest City and a project called 5M. Where all these different types of innovators are in the same campus, if you will, down there together. And we were the initial arts organization in there. And I think that basic feeling, that tenet point of you want to be in the middle of everything with everybody together, that's exciting. And I think that's what performance is. And I think that's why we have community places, our cultural places, is to be in the middle of all that, you know, kind of like being in the middle of BART or being in the middle of Muni or being in the middle of a food court, is that I think the Bay Area allows, you know, you have a beautiful older institution that's been there forever on Geary with that big, beautiful building that the Geary that ACT is in. But then you also have places that are not that and are also not, are open to different people. I grew up in San Francisco, so like the notion of a place like the Ballet or ACT, they just seem like big buildings when you grew up here, you know, and you want to have a city that has all of the offerings from those big, beautiful buildings to also a building with a glass door that's open or that has people out in front of it and say, come on in. And be like that. And I think Intersection, we're right in the middle of making that happen and trying to discover what that neighborhood is down there, you know, on Mission and between 5th and 6th down there.
And say more about Campo Santo.
Campo Santo is the longtime resident theater company there. And I think when the leader of Intersection for the Arts for the past 15 years, Deborah Cullinan, when she first came in, Intersection, like maybe what we had started to talk about, like, you know, theater, cultural events were on a downturn, and we thought, oh no, it's the end of everything type thing when it comes to cultural events. And Intersection was in a tough financial place. When she first came in, she wanted to populate the place. And so one of the first things she did was to open the doors, first of all, keep the doors unlocked and open. You want people in there, make your doors open. And then invited resident companies in just to populate the place. And so we've been there since 1996, since we started. And I think the mission is pretty simple with Campo Santo, which is to create, you know, tell some of the stories that don't get told and do it pretty directly as possible. Find a communing place, try and show pictures of the neighborhood and the city and the world we live in, using the words and the audience first of all and foremost, if that makes sense. If it doesn't sound too like
just words and people. That's all we're going to do.
Commuting in
but it,
spaces.
But it's what Karen said, too. You know, it's all about new work, too. And I think there's some, you know, that's at the heart of it. And I think you do new work because you want to get into a new space. You want to go into a new direction. You want new people there. You want new conversations to happen. And I think that's just a different starting place than, say, a regional theater, you know. And which isn't to say one is this and one is that. Mm-hmm. Just we have different missions. And so sometimes I think we're in the same ballpark, but sometimes you kind of wonder about it too.
So Karen, this idea of communing and opening the doors, let's shift a little bit to the audience. Who's showing up to theater and where? You know, are there different sort of demographic blocks that show up to different parts of the theater scene here? Is it truly as intermingled as Sean suggests? Start there.
I think it's definitely more intermingled than many people would suspect. I was at a Berkeley Rep opening maybe a week ago, and I remember thinking, that's a classic Berkeley audience, 20-somethings and, you know, clearly kind of vintage garb, scrounged from a local thrift shop, you know, just the kind of thing I used to do. And then, like, older people, and then, you know, hippies and tie-dye, but people who look like they could buy and sell the block if they wanted to. But, you know, all the different kinds of people you find. And it was so great to see them all sitting in that space, interacting with the theater. I mean, I do think, of course, different theaters attract different audiences. Money is a factor. You know, a lot of theaters now are the top end of the seats are getting close to $100. That is not something everybody's going to be able to spend. Theater company like Camposanto does a great job with a sliding scale that, you know, really allows for more people to come. Shotgun Players has a pay what you can, a really active play what you can program where literally I think if you just showed up with 35 cents, if they had a seat, they would let you come in because the mission of those kinds of theater companies is to make the art accessible. That's the single most important thing, I think, about what they do.
And places like ACT do that too, don't they? They have a pay what you
they
can.
They work really hard. I think ACT is one of the companies, many of them, I think Berkeley Rep is another example, that a couple of years ago, what they tried to do is make the lower price lower and the higher price higher because they realized on the high end, you know, the person doesn't care, 85 or 100 isn't a lot to that particular demographic. On the low end, the $5 or the $7 difference is huge. So you can actually increase the audience on both ends.
And so that's the economics of it, that there's an issue of accessibility based on the price. How about other aspects of accessibility to theater that might not just be about the ticket price?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the most interesting and controversial debates in the theater scene right now is sort of social media. I mean, all arts organizations are using social media to kind of build their brand. Some organizations have taken that, you know, to a really extreme arena. Tweet seats are something that is happening now in many theaters.
What's that?
They're actually seats that are designated for Twitter. Now, I'm sort of an older model of social engagement would be audiences who, theater companies that encourage the audience to tweet before the show. You know, hey, I'm at Camposanto, really cool scene. And then you shut off the phone and then you watch the show.
I would have thought the older model was the Q&A afterwards.
Right. Well, there, you know, we do live in the Bay Area. I think we love the arts and we love our technology. We love our gadgets. Mm. That's, I think, the emergence of digital culture has really happened all over the world. But here first, right, I think we're way ahead in terms of, like, really loving our technology and wanting to be holding our phone for as much of the day as is possible. And so some theater companies, SF Playhouse, I think, was one of the first around here, said, well, they got tired of sort of policing people, you know, shut off the phone, you know, don't text. Oh, I think someone had their phone on. And so they made, they sort of tried to co-opt that energy. They now have designated tweet seats. They're in the back of the theater, so you're not, you know, bothering other patrons. And you're encouraged to tweet. You know, tweet to the actors, tweet the director, tweet to each other. And it's sort of another way of encouraging, you know, what a talkback would have done, getting people to interact with the art so they're not sitting there as sort of a passive consumer. They're actually having an experience, entering into a discourse, if you will, with the artist.
And are the artists and the director tweeting back in real time?
In many cases, they are.
Are you serious?
In many cases, they are. At Bring It On, which was a touring show last year, but we didn't encourage, you know, Twitter during the show. They don't do that there. But they encouraged the audience, at the intermission, that people tweet. And there was a huge amount of traffic back and forth between the cast and, you know, I think a lot of the audience members, certainly a lot of the cheerleaders in the audience, I think, were tweeting back and forth with the cast. But that can be cool, too. I mean, I was tweeting from a production at San Jose Stage about a week ago, not during the show, but at the intermission. And the crew running the show started to tweet me back. And we had a whole conversation, you know, about Sam Shepard and Buried Child. And it was fun, I have to admit. There's a certain instant gratification factor with the technology. That makes the experience of going to the theater very accessible. And I think it's part of a wider movement of many theaters, you know, many of the kind of sort of showcase theaters we were talking about, that are people are trying to make the theater a friendlier place. You can now often bring your drinks in. You can bring your snacks in. They want to make it seem a little less formal and stuffy.
So they should have checked it out, what it sounds like to be crunching on potato chips doing really poignant scenes of theater, which happened
Indeed.
To me when I was actually watching a West Side Story in New York a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
So people were chomping
Absolutely.
On chips.
Absolutely, and that's the double, the double-edged sword of it. On the other end of the spectrum, you have people who feel like, and I often feel this way, I'm deluged by computers all day long. It's always a glowing screen. The theater is this one place where I get to go, where everyone's going to shut them off, and we can actually have a human interaction. Mm-hmm. It can be one-on-one. It's all about, you know, Sean and another actor on a tiny space, having more of a, you know, like as you were saying in the old days with Greek theater and a cathartic ritual in it, maybe it shouldn't be about Twitter. So that is the controversy.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing theater in the Bay Area with our guests Sean San Jose from Intersection for the Arts and co-founder of their resident theater company Camposanto, and Karen D'Souza, theater critic for the Bay Area Newspaper Group. It's time for you to call in with your questions and comments, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. I'm not sure if we're up on Twitter, actually. But anyway, 415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or Facebook, look for us at City Visions. And if you are a theater goer, we'd like to hear about what your experience of theater here in the Bay Area is, what you've seen recently that's perhaps a shift in the kind of theater you've experienced before, what kinds of innovations you like, what kind of innovations you don't like, what your sense of the vitality of theater in the Bay Area is. 415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or our Facebook page, City Visions. So let's turn back to you, Sean, on this topic of technology. So do you allow tweeting at Intersection for the Arts?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think what Karen brings up at the heart of it is right. You know, whatever is going to make you feel engaged in it, you know, and if you can have a place in the story in some way, if you can be involved in it, and if that makes it more accessible for you, that's great. And, you know, I think those ideas are cute and cool and everything. I think it speaks to a bigger thing, though, is like, who is it for and why is it for? And all those really big questions, you know. Again, like I said, at Intersection, we're in a big change mode, you know. So our leader, Deborah Cullinan, is tasking us to, you know, you have to remember to think about what is the mission of the thing, what is the goal, what do you want to achieve from it. And so what would be the goal of any of these things? What would be the goal of doing a show, per se, to get subscribers to come? That would be cool. I mean, again, like, if you're one of the seven theaters that exist on that model. But it's interesting, too, and Karen could speak to this as well. You know, you sit on these theater panels, and year after year, you know, I wasn't on them back in the day, but I can tell you they had the same questions. How do we make our audiences younger? How do we make them more diverse? How do we do something that's going to bring in new people? And I think we start with these really immediate, reactive things, and we never really take the real time to stop, assess, survey, and look around. Like, who are you telling the story for, and who are you trying to reach with the stories? And I think that goes through a number of things, like who gets to tell, that whose text gets to be up there, whose face gets to be up there, what does that face look like, what does it sound like, what modes can be used in it, and to more basic things, like Karen's saying, like, if everyone comes into, you know, down Mission Street at Fifth Street and everybody be on their phone, then yeah, maybe that mode would be great and more acceptable, if you know, or more accessible to folks. But I think we also we forget about the rest, you know, the other 85% of the people that didn't grow up going to theater and the ballet, that don't think it's for them, that don't think that they have stories out there that can be told and heard and seen and recognized and aligned with and connected to. And I think that's the big ongoing, exciting, you know, really fun mission of it, is like, who are you telling it to? And I think if you know who you're telling it to, they're going to dictate to you how and what modes are going to be the most effective modes. I mean, there's always going to be artists doing their thing, and that's what makes the Bay Area beautiful in that way. But if we truly want to get to a new ground with things where we're really creating a new performance audience, we might even have to get rid of like terms like theater, you know, or, you know, regional theater, all these terms that mean something to like people like me and Karen, because that's our field. But why would we want to, you know, perpetuate that little small circle that just keeps going around and around? If we want new, we keep saying new people, but then we're scared to really make a new model for the thing.
So why that hesitation to say it and then have difficulty in going in directions that may deliver it?
I guess because we're scared, you know.
And
you
know,
I think of losing maybe money or audience or control or what stories you know how to tell or how you tell them well. And I think that we're also not all aligned with the same beliefs about it. I mean, I think Karen's right. We do a lot of new work out here, but even within new work, like, why are you doing new work? Are you doing new work because more of them go on to New York because of new work? Or are you doing it because people want to see a new story because they're going to be in the new story? Or that's a new way to respond or a new way to connect. And so I think we have to define all those things for ourselves as a community, and obviously within your own mission statement.
So say more about this idea of those who didn't necessarily have theater growing up or don't see theater reflecting their experience. Let's get granular about who we're talking about here.
I, you know, it's like everything else in the United States, it's class and race stuff. So, like, you know, Karen said it, like, if a ticket costs $100, I think even the three of us in this room would be like, you know what I mean, unless it's something really, really special. But I grew up in, I never went into a theater until, you know, I was an adult practically. You know, my mother saw one play my entire life that I knew of, and that's because it was Al Pacino. It wasn't because of a play or the notion of what communing in a theater or connecting to a live experience could mean. But we love movies and we love music, you know, and we dance around the house. And I think we sort of either have been told or have been taught ourselves that those are two separate things, when they're really not two separate things, especially now. I mean, everyone's active, everyone's creative, everyone's going to respond. And I think that, you know, if we don't allow and create these opportunities when folks are little, then when are they going to get those opportunities? And then we're going to be playing to the same percentage of people. And that's not a big enough percentage to pass around to a bunch of theaters, the same people that want to do it. And I think because we're scared ultimately of giving way to our plot of land, when, you know, the outcome is so much greater when you just open the thing back up and you go, oh, this is what the Bay Area looks like. I want the whole entire Bay Area to be up in here, you know. We've always thought about it at Intersections, you know, you expand, you start with your corner, and then you move to the rest of the neighborhood, to the city and beyond that way. And we're in the process of trying to relearn that, having just moved down to, you know, Mission between 5th and 6th, who are neighbors, who are actually the citizens that live on those blocks down there on Minna and Natoma and 6th Street. And I think that's kind of where it starts for us. I mean, even look at where the theaters are, like, you know, the ballet's downtown, you know. I always thought it was part of City Hall, you know what I mean? No one lives there, you know. No, who gets to go around there, you know? And you don't know that it's for you. And if you don't know it's for you, then you're never going to think like that, and then you're never going to want to create a story like that. And so, I mean, to be granular, like you say about it, I think it's anyone that can't afford it, or anyone that looks up on a stage and doesn't see their face or their auntie's face or their mom's face on it, or doesn't hear a story that sounds like a story that maybe one of your cousins told, or you saw in your grandma's, you know, photo albums, things
or you
like
imagined
that.
Yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what I mean? And I mean, that's how it was for me even, you know, like I even read, you know, all of us had to read the Shakespeare in high school and whatnot, and Shaw and all that, you know, Arthur Miller and all the good stuff. But that feels like that's like pretend, you know what I mean? Until you get to experience it live. I mean, there's something about theater that's different than all the other things. That's why growing up, we all responded to movies because it could look like your house. It could look like, but then when you get in a room and you see a person talking and it's just a mom talking to her son, who couldn't recognize that, you know? That's why you mentioned Off the Air, West Side Story. That's why, you know what I mean? Like, that's like, that was the only sort of point of reference I ever had to what theater could be, because my mother loved it, because my mother related to being, you know, a woman that could be like one of the women in the piece, you know what I mean? And I think there's something in that. And there's also like all kinds of like jive rules that we make up about performance. Like, you have to get your tickets in this way. That's why I love this idea about Twitter. If you use Twitter and that's going to get you in there, cool, do it. If you use a Clipper card and that's going to get you to do it, if you use your phone and that's going to get you to do it, if you're not used to paying for things, then okay, let's figure out how we can get you interested first of all, and then kind of go from there.
What are some more of these other jive rules that you're talking about?
Well, like, you know, like that theater actually has rules. Like, who's to say that, who made that up? You know what I mean? And if you made it up, who has the rule book to it? And then why would I be allowed to participate in it if there's this supposed rule book? And, you know, you look outside, like ACT's beautiful openings, it could be daunting. It could be intimidating, man. Mm-hmm. It's intimidating for me to go to an opening at Berklee Repertory, not because I don't want to see Rita Moreno do her thing or something like that, but because it's a different, it's a costuming, and it feels like there's a different set of rules that I maybe didn't get the email to sometimes, or just that I have a messed up, you know, sense of insecurity. But I don't think you feel that way, say you go to your place of faith, or you go to your grandmother's house, or you go to a block party. I don't think you feel that way. I mean, I think you have your little nerves or whatever if you're going to go to a picnic that's in the middle of a park. And it's, but, you know, like, if you go to your place, you know, even as kids, and, you know, whatever religion aside, like, to go to a place of communing like that, you don't feel like, uh-oh, you know what I mean? You feel like, uh-oh, because your mother is going to tell you to do something this way.
Right, but there are obviously rules in those communal spaces, but perhaps you're aware of them.
Right.
Yeah, and It's also welcoming, you know what I mean? Like, they sit at the doors and they I think they say welcome, you know what I mean? Which is a little different than, you know, you have to know how to get the ticket and purchase the ticket and all that stuff. And I just think there's this whole set of freeways that lead up to the path, the road that actually leads to being in live performance spaces together. And we kind of don't address those ones as often as we do the things that are, you know, easier to be reactive about in the moment. And they're cool ideas. Like, I'm not saying, like, pay what you can is a great idea. Twitter, whatever the thing is going to be this year, those are great ideas. But that's within the context that we all agree that we know what live theater or performance events even mean. Like, I don't even know what, there's a large part of me growing up, I didn't know what that meant. I looked at the date book for movie times. I didn't look at it for anything else. You know what I mean? And who's gonna indoctrinate us, or better yet, invite us into all of those situations? I don't know. Hopefully we will.
Yeah. This is City Visions on local public radio, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And we were just listening to Sean San Jose there. He's a staff member of Intersection for the Arts, the program director of the performance program, and one of the co-founders of the resident theater company, Campo Santo. And we're also joined here tonight by Karen D'Souza. She's theater critic for the Bay Area Newspaper Group. She's sat twice on Pulitzer Prize drama juries and has served as the vice chair for the American Theater Critics Association. And her writing has appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, Los Angeles Angeles Times and American Theater Magazine. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation tonight. 415-841-4134. You could also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go to Millie from Oakland. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm in Berkeley, actually, but I know that there has been, in the dim past, I haven't paid attention for a long time, a black theater in Oakland, which I haven't heard you mention, and I wondered whether in the discussion of the financial level of the variety of people in the theater, you saw racial distinction. That's particularly interesting to me.
Say a little bit more about what you mean by that question.
The Berkeley Rep did Otto Fugard's plays.
So say a little bit more about the distinction you're asking about.
Well, I'm asking what the racial composition of the theater is.
Which particular theater?
Berkeley Rep or San Francisco, for that matter. And then there is a black theater, or was a black theater, in Oakland. I wondered if it succeeded.
You know, and I have to say, I'm not as on top of this as I once was, but I think you're talking about Oakland Ensemble Theater, and they have grappled with financial troubles, I think, pretty much as long as I can remember. I believe they are no longer active, but I don't know that they won't be.
Yeah, and there's also Black Repertory Theater.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Does that get at your question there?
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. So to stay with that discussion that we were just talking about, accessibility of theater is sort of the theme that's been running through our discussion so far. There's the question of economics, and then there's the question of what's seen as inviting and relevant and welcoming, and that comes from your discussion, Sean, of concerns of growing up. What messages do people get about how theater is relevant to their life and encourages them to participate? And then we talked about technology as an avenue for getting people drawn in. And then there's the question of education and how funding for arts education may be affecting the way children grow up appreciating or developing appreciation or connection to the arts. Those are just some of the areas that we've touched upon there. And I'm curious which of any of these we could sort of jump off more of and really delve into in the next 20 minutes or so. And we do have a call coming in and an email that I want to get to in just a moment as well. But just any thoughts?
Well, what really struck me about what Sean said is I think it is so true. Certainly, I think Campo Santo, one of the most noteworthy things about the company is how connected you guys have always felt. I mean, to the old venue in the Mission, it always very much felt like the art was coming from the community and reflecting the community, being inspired by the community, and channeling it in this way that, you know, I'm not sure if any other theater company in the Bay Area had that feeling of tapping into the source. You know, having lived in the Mission for a while, you really always felt like, this is it. This is the real deal. And I think it's very true that people, we like stories that we recognize and identify with, but I don't know that we can draw such neat and tiny boundaries. I mean, I wasn't always drawn to plays or movies about, you know, being an Indian chick growing up in Fremont. I had my first potent theater experience reading Othello on a plane to India with my parents when I was a kid, where I thought, well, this is going to have nothing to do with me, but I'm stuck on the airplane, so I'm going to read it. And then you realize, no, it's everything about me. It's about class. It's about race. It's about sex. It's, you know, you saw the universality of the tale. And I think for me, that's what keeps bringing me back to the arts is like I go to a play that I think will have nothing to do with me. It's not about my life. It's not about my time. And yet you have that out-of-body experience where you realize it all art, essentially, if it's really good art, should speak to everyone. You should be able to have no idea about the world of the play and yet be sucked into it.
Hmm. You seem very taken by that comment,
right,
Sean.
It's just beautifully stated, and I think that's why anyone that is interested in performers in theater or any kind of cultural event, that experience that Karen describes has happened to all of us. I mean, I don't mean to sound like such a contrarian in terms of like, well, you have the established theater world and then you have the rest of us. But what I do want to acknowledge, and I think we don't acknowledge enough, is there is an established model and then there's the rest that, and we can concentrate a little bit more on making the rest more, you know, a stronger and have a more formidable and be more representative of the world that we live in, if that's the point. To me, that's the point of theater, in particular live performance. You want to reflect the world that you live in. And if it looks only one way and is the same story or a story that has been told over and over, it's imbalanced, and it's not going to be as dynamic and lively as the world we live in. And especially, I mean, we're in the Bay Area, man, you know? So it should be as lively as the Bay Area is in that way. And it's just in terms of a focus of where you want to go. And I know that sometimes I'll speak, and then you put Berkeley and ACT and then other places on the other end. It's not to sort of posit that we're working against each other. But one has an established model, and one is trying to fortify new folks and invite new folks as a priority. And I think those are two different things.
415-841-4134 to join our conversation tonight here on City Visions at KLW San Francisco about theater in the Bay Area with Sean San Jose of Intersection for the Arts and Karen D'Souza, theater critic with the Bay Area Newspaper Group. 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And let's go to Liz from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just wanted to bring in one other element in terms of, you know, you've talked already about the issues of making it affordable and making it accessible to people and being in the neighborhood, but I had an experience last year. I am a playwright, and my director and I actually started a new theater company, and we had a play that was dealing with homelessness and mental illness, mm-hmm. and so we wanted to do it in the Tenderloin, and we wanted to bring in the people for whom the play would have the most meaning. And of course, and we did it in the Tenderloin, in the theater, in the basement of St. Boniface Church, right there in the heart of it. But the other, and we made it absolute pay what you can, but we did a huge community outreach element. Because mm-hmm. we knew we couldn't just put up posters and do the regular thing that you do in theater. So we went out and went to meetings of the Central City SRO Collaborative and went to the mm-hmm. Tenderloin Health Clinic and went and met advocates doing the work. And, you know, at times we were like, are we really going to get these audiences? And we did. We had huge, you know, we had big groups of people coming from SROs and coming from health clinics. And we could tell from our audience surveys, we had people who'd never been to live theater before in their life. And we had like over 110 people average every performance.
You sound surprised by your own success.
Well, I mean, it was interesting. And we also dealt with sometimes people, theater people who I greatly respect, going, so you're really going to have homeless people in there? You know, are they, you know, kind of like, are they going to know the rules of theater? Mm. And we just dove ahead and did it. And, I mean, we literally had the people who sleep outside the church every night coming in. And it was an amazing experience. And
so
it was
so how was it amazing?
Not only for us, but for the kind of regular theater-going audience told us how it changed it for them to be in the audience with people for whom this was their lived experience. Being on the street. And so I just want to say, I think that's one thing theaters have to think about. You can't just make it affordable and just make it relevant and just have it in the neighborhood. You really have to go out to where people are if you want people who aren't the regular theater-going audience.
Yeah, I mean, Liz is talking about a really special experience, which also involves really special effort. I mean, what they did involves a fullness of effort. And I think that's the part I think sometimes we forget about when you're doing culture events, whether they be theater or any type of live performances. Again, like, who are you trying to reach? Like, she answered that question. They answered that question. They did the work on it. So you're doing two types of new work. One is new in terms of, like, who is it for, new work, and the actual, you know, whatever you want to call it, quote-unquote, piece of writing or performance or music. And I think those are just different philosophies, you know, about how to be part of a community, you know. And I believe in and am inspired by that story.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience, and I think it'll change how I do theater from here on out.
Very good. Thanks, Liz, so much for your call.
All right.
So let's go back now to something about technology? Because we started on the Twitter thing, and then you took us in a very important direction there, Sean. How is technology affecting the stories that get told?
That's
so
an interesting question.
The way people process information, the way they connect attention spans, how does it affect the kind of work that gets written?
I think in many senses, I mean, there has been a shift. Something you see is more and more great young playwrights, you know, also try and write for HBO. They want to go back and forth, which makes a lot of sense financially, certainly. And in terms of getting her name out there, I was talking about Annie Baker and thinking of her in specific. But a lot of people go back and forth now. And I think you sometimes see that in the work. You see more of a colloquial kind of speech and a fluidity with naturalism. Things tend to move faster than maybe they would have been if the plays weren't so deeply influenced by other mediums, all of which I think can be to the good. I think it is important for the work on stage to reflect the way we actually speak and the way things happen in the world around us. And I think in that sense, I think that kind of cross-pollination is very positive.
Mm. Sean?
Yeah, I don't think we know yet, you know? Meaning, I think Karen's absolutely right. Like, it should reflect, I mean, that's my opinion too, it should reflect the way that people speak in the world. And I think to take the time to develop a piece and to create that mimicry of what that rhythm sounds like takes 2-3 years. Maybe we're already off the mark there. I think we're also, you know, it's like, who are we asking to tell your rhythm? What do you sound like, and what are you interested in? What is your attention span, and what, you know, I think you can be moved by anything. I think people were as moved by anything in the Bay Area in recent years when Tony Kushner's play that opens with a 30-minute monologue with a woman sitting in a chair, you know, I think people were completely floored by that. So I think the modality is, you know, I think that's one thing, but I don't think we've done the research or asked the real opinion, like, you guys, 16, 17, you guys are really feeling these, like, phony reality shows. Is that what you want to see on stage? Or, like, you like video games. Do you want to see that reflected? I don't know if people would really want to see that. Or do you want everything to be in really brief dialogues, like 140 characters like that? I don't know. I don't know. I don't think any of us know the answer to that yet. I think.
And how do you find out?
You gotta ask the questions. I mean,
like, how though?
Well, I think Liz said an interesting one right there. If they're doing it, theirs is really specific to a neighborhood, so they went right to the neighbors and they asked the neighbors. But I think that's the long, long, long process that starts with knocking on doors and then opening up your doors. You have to know what stories people have in them, and therefore what stories they would want to see reflected back. Which, again, like, just to be specific, that doesn't mean that we're creating, like, documentary theater. I think what Karen said is absolutely right. Like, if you note pain and heartache in a Shakespeare monologue, you're going to note it whether you're red, blue, orange, you know, a clown or a horse, you know, if you're in the theater.
So you're not saying throw out the classics, obviously, but how do you, in making other these new works, how do you make room or keep room, if there needs to be room, any room kept, for classics that get I don't know, presented in a way that does reach an audience that thinks it's not for them?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one, because I don't, that's just not the world that I work in. But, you know, there are places, California Shakespeare Theater, you know, that Jonathan Moscone runs, that I think they do a fabulous job of making it fluidly go between what feels like very much right now today to, you'll see period costumes, you'll hear Shakespeare's text as it was written. But I think I'm talking also about, you know, a larger thing in terms of just what stories do you want to hear in the basic most sense, you know, deep down in you. Like, again, like, it doesn't need to be a documentary of what a neighborhood looks like, but if your stories are about struggle, if your stories are about diaspora, if your stories are about spaces in between or hurting or missing or longing, I think those are things that anyone can figure out with time and care and asking someone their actual opinion, you know.
So the themes obviously seem to be to carry through. It's perhaps the frame, the faces, the context that
and I
that
think to
shifts.
Know that you're part of the table, that you're invited to the table. Right. I think that's a big thing. You know, I know that for me personally. Like, if you see something that's really fabulously done and beautiful and flashy and all that, if you don't know that you have a stock in it in some ways, even if it means, like what Karen was saying, like, if I know I can tweet and say, this is bull crap or this is beautiful, then at least I know, like, hey, my vote counts. Right. You know, somewhere
your
in the Twitter universe.
Respected.
Yeah.
Right. So how is Campo Santo, besides the sliding scale? Because remember, Liz said to us, it's not just about changing the ticket scale.
Right.
Right. How is Campo Santo doing that? How is it reaching out in ways to make people feel like this is a place for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we started, you know, the program specifically that Campo Santo does, you know, really led by Intersection, we do something called, that we started, you know, maybe 12 years ago now, called Open Process. And the notion of Open Process is that, A, you open up the process so it's not like pretend or make-believe and that everyone's welcome. But more importantly, it's the themes, questions, ideas, concerns that are in whatever a playwright, a composer, a visual artist that they're starting with. Is that relevant to you? And if, in which ways is it relevant? And in which way can you inform our story by responding to that question?
So who's in those conversations?
I think it ranges from the topic, but it goes from your neighbors. Again, like, I think neighbors is a really, really, really key thing. And I think it's something that we often forget about, especially when you have a sort of a downtown scene where you think there isn't a neighborhood.
Do you ever reach out to schools or other groups and say, come on in, we want to work through some ideas with you of how to make this happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what Open Process means, is, you know, you find the subject and then you find who that subject really addresses and who is really affected by it. And then they hopefully will inform us, and by them informing us, we're hopefully giving them something back by, you know, giving them voice and also giving them a place to tell their story, maybe that they haven't been afforded that opportunity, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just about opening up the doors again. Like, at the end of the day with a play, you want to be like, oh, I saw this thing, let's start talking about it. And so rather than starting at that point, we start there at the very beginning. You go, what would you want to talk about? What is relevant to you? Is spousal abuse interesting? Mm-hmm. Is drug abuse interesting? Mm-hmm. Is love? Is immigration? Is vehicles or shoes? Whatever it is. You know,
right. So theater going maybe from didactic, this is what you should be thinking about or seeing, to more experiential and drawing in. And universal, but universal in a way that draws from the contemporary.
I think so. I think, yeah, it might be more basic than that, just like what's relevant to you.
Okay. Karen, it looks like you wanted to say something.
That's such an interesting point Sean brings up, and it really, I think, in some ways is a fundamental tension now, maybe across the theater scene, but certainly with a sort of big box theater, is this notion of, should the art be rooted in the community? Should it be art that could only happen here in the Bay Area because it speaks to us? Versus, you know, lately there have been a lot of co-productions happening. Many theater companies partner up with another theater company because they want to cut costs and save resources. There have been a lot of imports coming from all over the world, really, a lot of global art. And I think a lot of us would like to see, you know, certainly local actors employed. Mm-hmm. We want to see a lot of homegrown art. On the other hand, you know, The Wild Bride came to Berkeley Rep from Cornwall, and it was this wonderful fairy tale that I felt really privileged that it had come all the way here so I could see it, because it certainly wasn't going to Cornwall. And I think that having that kind of cross-pollination globally can be very good for all of us and all the arts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think even the notion of theater, again, like, it needs to be broken open a little bit. Going back to what we were saying, like, what are the forms that we're doing? I mean, in a lot of ways, I think the most interesting things happening are maybe not even in theater. You look at what Bill T. Jones does. You look at someone like Rennie Harris, Pure Movement. And then a lot of the dance is even breaking down their own definitions of it, whether it's someone that I know well, like the Erica Chung Shuck Performance Project, people like the Embodiment Project, Mixed Ingredients, groups that are using the actual elements that they relate to tell the story that way. So I think text first, maybe, but maybe not. You know what I mean?
And if you look at something like Fela, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Bill T. Jones. Sometimes things come full circle and take over Broadway.
Right.
And so the arts can really feed each other. I think that they should certainly do more.
And is that your goal at some point, to take over Broadway? And really, seriously,
take over
though,
the world for us. Right. You know, Broadway's included in it. That's
Broadway's
cool, too.
Part of the world.
But really, to say, like, you know, we're gonna really push this form to really change what happens at those upper levels or upper echelons, if you may.
I don't know. I mean, because you're talking about economy, and I'm not that foolish enough to think that I could change the economy. I think I could be one of the people that stands in the middle of the Bay Area and let you know that you're a part of the Bay Area and you're part of the world that you live in. I know that sounds a little sort of peace and love-ish, but I think we can accomplish...
It's been consistent with your comments all evening.
But hey, man, we can accomplish peace and love, but I don't think we can accomplish, you know, rewriting the Constitution or the economy.
Mm. An interesting email from Donald says, I was in a very well-reviewed show a few years back and we played to half houses night after night. One night I left the theater and noticed a line of people waiting to get into a new hot restaurant. That is unfortunately the new form of theater in San Francisco. Oh. I've had a good friend say to me, when I finally get a night free, I'm going out to a new restaurant, not to your new show.
Oh.
Any comments on that?
I mean, I think there certainly is a lot of foodie culture in the Bay Area. I think it is something a lot of people like. Although the question I always get is, it seems to me, I think in this economy especially, people don't go out for the big fancy meal as often as they used to. Mm. They don't necessarily want to go to a show as much as they used to. But when they do it, they want to do it big. Mm. They want to have a real night out experience.
Would you include food, restaurant as part of that sort of expanded...
I think it can be, for sure, especially in the Bay Area, yeah. But I think there's probably something to that, too, that is like, it's something that we think we don't know what it is, and so we think it's exciting. And I think, to some degree, I think, especially like that person, you know, they know what that person's shows are like, so you go, I've seen your stuff, man. Yeah, that's cool, but I don't know what this mixture change-up thing is going to be at this place and what kind of cocktails they have. So if it's new and exciting... You know, I think we just need to make our performance new and exciting then.
So we're running out of time. I have a question from Jim, an email from Jim from San Francisco. Do the guests, I mean specifically you, Sean, believe that no one will come see Campo Santo just because they moved to the Union Square area, which is technically not true. You're in the mm-hmm. south of Market mm-hmm. area. But given that you've changed your neighborhood, how is that going to affect your ability to draw an audience? Do you, if you, I mean, I know, I don't think you feel like your audience is specific to the old neighborhood you were in.
Well, I mean, it's what we're in the middle of right now. I think, again, like, we're trying to figure out how we can introduce ourselves, you know, organically and truly to our neighbors. But also, you know, if the work speaks to people, it speaks to people. I mean, we haven't stopped working. We did a big show at the D. Young, and I think, you know, 1,000 people showed up or whatever, and we're in the middle of a run right now that people are showing up to. We're doing a new piece right now that this great musician, writer, Dennis Kim has written, and Mark Bamuti Joseph, an incredible performance visionary, directed, and we're doing that now. And
what's it called?
It's called Tree City Legends. And actually, this is the final week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Intersection. I mean...
And how can people find out about tickets?
People can go to the Intersection, theintersection.org, or where everyone goes to brown paper tickets, and it's Tree City Legends, Tree City Legends. And again, like, this is a story, I think, what we're doing in that has a lot of the elements we're talking about. It's music, it's liturgy, it's communing, it's text, it's movement, it's all of those things together in one piece. And it's interesting to see what kind of responses people have to that.
And Karen, any last thoughts about what we could see coming up in other parts of the theater scene in the Bay Area? Very
so
quickly
much.
Here.
I mean, it's a fantastic, lots of great solo shows at the Marsh. You know, big in terms of the big Broadway type stuff. War Horse is coming. There's a revival of Pinter's Caretaker with Jonathan Pryce that I'm really excited about. Really, no matter what kind of theater you love, it is happening. It's out there.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Sean San Jose of Intersection for the Arts and Karen D'Souza of the Bay Area Newspaper Group. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to listen to previous programs, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show is produced by Lisa Denenmark. CityVision's senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Fries manages our website. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer next Monday when we cover the topic juvenile sex trafficking in the Bay Area. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.